In this episode of The Blend, Europe experiences extreme heat and the mainstream media loves it, a New Hampshire distillery turns invasive crabs into whiskey, the world's largest carbon capture plant was switched on in Iceland, and lab-grown meat is in the limelight. You're listening to The Blend on the Greenerhouse Podcast channel. Hello and welcome to The Blend on the Greenerhouse Podcast channel. I'm Chris Syracuse, and we are broadcasting from Bali in the Indonesian archipelago, specifically the south coast, Uluwatu. If you've listened to the show before, you know that it used to be called The Weekly Blend. And then you also know that it has not been weekly, hence the name change. It's now going to be The Blend because I can't keep up and I can't commit to and live up to the name of The Weekly Blend. So it's the Whenever I Feel Like It, Whenever I Have Time Blend, or just The Blend. So thank you for bearing with me. Sorry it's been so long. Hopefully I'm going to be more consistent with this. Rushi and I will hopefully be coming out with a new episode of What's What. We're going to be talking about Timothy Leary and Ram Dass. So stay tuned. A little plug for What's What. But you're here for eco, environmental news, earth-conscious news, information. So let's go ahead and jump into it. This week, today's July 20th, 2022. And the big news, as far as environmental news, climate change news, nature news, if you will, the heat waves that are ravaging Europe right now and the wildfires that are blazing across Europe and the UK. And as we would expect, as we've come to expect, the mainstream media has jumped on this and used this as complete, unassailable proof that human-induced climate change is a thing and it's real. And if you know my perspective and you've listened to the show before, you know that I don't doubt that. Humans create a tremendous amount of heat in the form of burned carbon-based fuels, and that heat needs to be dissipated, needs to be dissolved through natural physical processes, and the rate at which we are putting these gases and this heat into the atmosphere, the Earth's natural processes cannot dissolve them and mitigate them and equalize them in the way that they could before the industrial era began. So with all that being said, let's go to the NPR article that describes the situation in Southern Europe. The headline reads, "Heat torches Southern Europe, killing hundreds." And we begin. The heat wave broiling Europe spilled northward Monday to Britain and fueled ferocious wildfires in Spain and France, which evacuated thousands of people and scrambled water-bombing jets and firefighters to battle flames in tinder-dry forest. Two people were killed in the blazes in Spain that its prime minister linked to global warming, saying climate change kills. Okay, right there. So just in the first couple sentences of this article, you see very clearly what I mean when I say at the beginning that the mainstream media loves this. They love it because in their minds, this confirms everything they believe to be true about climate change, which is one, it's caused exclusively by humans, which that's debatable. It may be exacerbated. It more than likely is being exacerbated by humans, but to point it exclusively to humans is absurd. The climate has changed throughout Earth's history, will continue to change, but whatever. And that's the first point. Second point is that if you even begin to question that fundamental principle that climate change is real, it's caused exclusively by humans, if you question that, you are literally killing people. That is implicitly and sometimes explicitly what mainstream news outlets are saying, what liberal-leaning news outlets and liberal politicians in America are saying, that's what climate change activists are saying if you're not on board, you are killing people. Now, there's a huge problem with this. The problem is there is no direct connection between the amount of each individual's carbon footprint. There's no connection between that and singular extreme weather events like we see here in Europe. There's just no connection. There's absolutely no way to say who individually, what country collectively produced all these carbon-based emissions and caused this particular heat wave. It's just impossible. There's no way to say, because the reality is that with the exception of a very, very, very small minority of people on Earth, that the vast majority of people, especially people in developed Western countries, use and engage with these systems, these industrial systems that produce these carbon emissions. That's just the reality. We all use this stuff every frickin' day. So for people on the left, specifically people like the people at NPR that just love to point to singular weather events like heat waves, as devastating as they are, but people like that like to point to these singular weather events and say, this is proof of climate change. And if you're not on board, you're killing people. Okay. Well, again, unless you're one of those few people in the world that lives out in the cabin somewhere in the woods and doesn't leave and lives in the most like sustainable way possible, you really have no room to talk because there's no way. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if you really want to match up carbon emissions on an individual level, from my perspective, what I see a lot of, and this is, you could quantify this, but this is in no way scientific. This is anecdotal, but you know, I've talked to a lot of people living here in Bali. I talked to a lot of travelers, a lot of privileged Westerners that come here. A lot of them claim to care about these issues. You know, they'll focus on climate change because they don't really know how else to describe earth conscious principles and sustainable living. They just think climate change and that's just it. But the point is that you talk to a lot of these people, and these are the same kind of people that work at NPR and, you know, on the progressive end of the political spectrum in America. When you talk to a lot of these people, there is this huge disconnect, which is they think that just because they believe in the science, that somehow just that belief puts them on higher moral footing or higher moral standing than other people. But the reality is, you talk to a lot of these people, and compared to the vast majority of other people in the world, their carbon footprint is probably much, much greater, because these are the people that eat out at fancy restaurants. These are the kind of people that travel all over the fucking world. These are the kind of people that live these kind of decadent lives by the worldwide standard that progressive elites in America, they of a sort of like the higher socioeconomic group, those people by and large live very luxurious lives compared to the rest of the world. So it's just there's just this huge disconnect and this like glaring hypocrisy with these people, that they want to keep hold of all of those things, yet they want to turn around and say, well, as long as I believe in the science of climate change, it doesn't really matter what I do. You know, I can do my virtue signaling. I can buy a Tesla. I can purchase like carbon credits so I don't feel bad about flying around the world. I can eat vegan and pretend that eating vegan is the most earth conscious thing I can do. I can buy my bamboo straws, blah, 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 blah. I can get on social media and I can post about these things. And that somehow will insulate me from the reality being that you produce these carbon emissions just like anybody else, and your carbon footprint is probably much greater than the average person in the world. Now, all that to say, getting back to the heat waves in Europe, getting back to the original point, there is no way to connect these singular weather events with specific actions taken by humans. There's just no way to do it. So people in the mainstream media are going to continue to take these weather events and use them as proof. They've got to point the finger back at themselves. And until these people go completely off grid and stop driving, stop traveling, stop enjoying all the luxuries of Western life, until they stop doing that, I don't really want to hear it. That's the reality of it. If you want to pretend that standing on your moral high ground is somehow putting you above all this and insulating you from the reality that you're also part of these systems, and you're enjoying all of the benefits of burning carbon-based fuels, then yeah, I just get a reality check. That's what I want to tell these people. If you're that fucking worried about it, just stop everything you're doing. Stop it all. Don't drive anywhere. Just sit in your fucking house. Okay, let's move on. I'm done with my climate change, climate activist, climate hypocrisy rant. Let's move on to some lighter fare. This is also from NPR, and I will definitely point out that I am a hypocrite. I just talk so much shit about NPR, yet I cite them all the time. So here we go. Here's an article from NPR. Article and a little audio clip as well. It says, a distillery is fighting invasive crabs by turning them into whiskey. And I'll read from the article. The article begins, green crabs are the invasive pests that have plagued North America's marine ecosystems for more than 200 years. Tamworth Distilling's Crab Trapper Whiskey gets some of its flavor from green crabs caught off the coast of New Hampshire. The crabs hitched a ride to the United States on ships coming from Europe around the 1800s. Here they eat tons of shellfish and destroy estuaries and fish habitats. So I'm just going to go ahead and play the audio clip from NPR. This is pretty cool. So this is a distillery. They've got all these invasive crabs. There's nothing really to do with them. They're just not that edible, or they're so small that they're just not really worth eating. But this distillery is turning them into whiskey. So let's go ahead and listen to the audio clip here. I mostly want to play it because this is just such a perfect example of how smarmy these people are at NPR, these hosts. They're just smarmy it's just this like, just not very genuine, overly enthusiastic. They just sound so douchey. So go ahead, let's listen to this and we can all laugh about it. Here we go. This is NPR talking about this green crab whiskey.
It's small, it's green, it's a crustacean, and now it's in whiskey.
People are going to hear crab whiskey, and I venture to say 3/4 of them are going to go, blah, no, absolutely not. But then when you actually, if you can get them to taste it, they totally changed their tune for the most part.
Will Robinson is a product developer at Tamworth Distilling. He decided one way to tackle the invasive species, green crabs, was to try to bottle them. First, he distills the crab stock in a vacuum still.
It looks like a crazy piece of laboratory equipment. It's taller. I'm 6'4", and it's taller than I am. The pot, so to speak, that the liquid goes in is a bulbous-shaped glass piece that holds about 20 liters, has a volume of about 20 liters of liquid.
Then he adds spices like paprika, dill, and cinnamon, and everything is mixed with a bourbon base.
It takes about a pound of crabs to make each bottle of whiskey, but it's going to take a lot more to get the green crab population under control.
Because there's so many of them. There's so many of them. They are probably one of the most successful invasive species that we have in North America, at least in the marine world.
Dr. Gabriella Brott, she's a fisheries specialist at the University of New Hampshire.
They can eat about 40 mussels a day, just one crab. And so you multiply that by a bazillion and you have no more clams, right?
So even though crab whiskey alone can't fix the problem, Brott says she hopes it helps by raising awareness.
And speaking of raising awareness, Juana, I understand that you get to have a taste of some of this green crab whiskey right there in the studio in DC.
That is right. We're going to try it out. I'm going to smell it first. Okay, so there's a lot of spices going on here. I definitely smell the paprika they talked about.
So does it actually taste like crab in any way?
No, I do not taste any crab. But there is a nice little heat, maybe like a cousin twice removed from Fireball. We'll mail you some.
Oh my God. These people are just so fucking fake and just so full of shit. But I do think this is pretty cool. The smarminess of these NPR hosts aside, I think this is a very simple, very just kind of fun, playful example of what I believe to be the new way of looking at Earth conscious living. Maybe not the new way, but a way that I think is more aligned with reality, which is adaptation, which is not, and I've been guilty of this, of having this kind of utopian vision of the world and of sustainable living, earth conscious living. But you start to realize very quickly when you start digging into these issues that utopian vision just does not, just like other utopian visions, it doesn't match with reality. So what I like about this is an example of just adapting, right? You've got this invasive crab species. Okay, whatever. I mean, yeah, invasive species, generally speaking, can be a problem. Like they describe in the article there, they can destroy ecosystems. They can put ecosystems out of whack, and they can just disrupt the natural order. But the reality is that, you know, these kind of things have happened for many, many centuries, where you had a species introduced into an ecosystem, and the ecosystem changes, the other organisms in the ecosystem adapt. And that's my point, is that humans have to do the same thing. We have to say, okay, let's not try to seal these places off and say this is our perfect little utopian, earth conscious, sustainable living ecosystem that we've created. Let's just deal with the reality. Okay, we've got these invasive crab species. Let's make some whiskey out of them. Again, it's a very simple, kind of fun, lighthearted example, but I think it's a good indication of how we should all start thinking about these things, which is just adapt, right? Don't have this idea of some perfect Eden. Just deal with what you've got. Adapt. If you got an invasive crab species, a shitload of crabs that you can't really do anything else with, make some whiskey out of them, right? Maybe that'll be a new expression. When life gives you green crabs, make whiskey. Doesn't really make any sense, but hey, we'll go with it. So there you go. And as usual, you know, I'll never miss a chance to call NPR out for its smarminess. So okay, let's move on to the next story here. This story is from IFL Science. If you're familiar with IFL Science, it means I fucking love science. So I haven't actually read anything from I fucking love science in a long time. But here we go. Let's jump into this, and we'll get back to the name of this publication, IFL Science, because it says a lot about this particular article and just this perspective in general. So the headline reads, "World's Largest Carbon Capture Plant Switched On in Iceland." And it goes on to say, "A machine capable of removing 4,000 tons of carbon dioxide from the air each year has just been switched on in Iceland. Plant, named Orca, after the Icelandic word for energy, is the largest carbon removal facility in the world, converting emissions into minerals that can be permanently stored deep underground." The article goes on to say, and I should say this article is actually from September of last year, so this is not current, but I think it's worth talking about. So the article goes on to say, "Using technology developed by Icelandic firm Carbfix, this carbon dioxide is then dissolved in water and buried deep inside the basalt rock formations that lie underground. Over a period of about 2 years, the carbon in the solution is crystallized into carbonate minerals, which fuse with the rock and become permanently trapped." Okay, so you probably know this if you listen to the show. I am highly skeptical of these technologically advanced solutions, quote unquote solutions to issues like carbon in the atmosphere. The reason that I'm so skeptical about this is because of that last paragraph that I read there. There is just this arrogance that a lot of us just cannot see it. We cannot get over it. We just believe that because we can do something and it seems like a good idea at the time, that we should. And to me, I don't know. I guess from a scientific perspective, I don't really know enough about this kind of engineering endeavor to say whether or not there could be second or third order effects. But it just seems like there is potential for some kind of unforeseen consequences of this. So you're sucking huge amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere. You're essentially just pushing it underground and letting it crystallize in these rocks. And they say it could become permanently trapped. Okay, but how do you know that? I mean, and at what point, I mean, do you have some kind of parameters for how much carbon can be put into this rock? Do you have any idea how this rock will react over time? Do you have any idea like whether or not this is stable form of this carbon? Like what's going on here? Like, how do you even begin to like understand what it is that you're doing when you're just shoving a whole bunch of carbon gas underground and then just letting it crystallize? That's just, I mean, you want to talk about fucking with things. That's definitely fucking with things. So I'm skeptical, but on the other hand, I will say it does sound kind of cool. I mean, yeah, just like that carbon out of the atmosphere, but you run into another problem, which is this is in Iceland and you've got to think, like, I've never been to Iceland, but I imagine that the air is pretty clean there, that compared to other places in the world, there's not a lot of excess carbon, so to speak, or a lot of these greenhouse gases. I mean, they're talking specifically about carbon dioxide, but how can this be applied at scale and in the areas where it's most needed? Because it seems to me that the article goes on to say that the underground basaltic rock formations in Iceland provide the ideal conditions for this process, providing a permanent solution for CO2 storage. Okay, so if the idea is to build these facilities next to power plants or next to other facilities, other industrial operations that produce a lot of carbon, wouldn't those places where you're building these carbon capture facilities, wouldn't they need to have those same basalt rock formations in order to provide these ideal conditions in order to make this thing actually work? Like, what's the point of just doing it up in Iceland when really these things need to be done at scale across many other places in the world? Probably the vast majority of the places don't have those same ideal conditions as far as the basalt rock in order to make this process work. So to me, I'm skeptical. Now we get to the more philosophical things at play here. So this is IFL Science. I fucking love science. That's the name of the publication. I'm not saying I fucking love science. But that just says so much about the perspective of the people that build these kind of technologies and the people that endorse them and write about them. Because what they're saying is they're saying that I believe in science, I believe in human ingenuity and human intelligence and the human understanding of the world kind of above anything else, right? There's this almost religious-like devotion to science that you see in specifically a lot of left-leaning circles, a lot of progressive on the political spectrum, a lot of those circles and a lot of those people, because there's no religion. And a lot of these people are secular or non-religious. They exist in secular communities and societies. So something needs to take the place of the belief in some higher power or some religious principle. I'm not advocating for religion necessarily. I am myself not, I don't subscribe to any specific religion, but I do find the value in believing in a higher power and saying that human intelligence and human understanding of the world is incredibly limited. People like these people at IFL Science, I just get the sense that they don't really believe that. They believe that science will save all, that we all must be committed with religious like zealotry to the ideas around science, and that science and the Church of Reason, it has its own dogma, it has its own like sacraments, and it must be followed. And that is the exact opposite of what the scientific method actually is. The scientific method is a circular process. It's a continual process of questioning what it is that you think you know. And in a lot of ways, religion and spiritual pursuits, they kind of pave the way for science. They say, and different things like, you know, mysticism and these things that exist kind of on the periphery of what we can perceive with our eyes and our ears and our senses, that they exist on the periphery of these, and they can kind of help light the way for science. But for a lot of these people, the people that believe that science and technology is the ultimate, they don't look at it that way. They look at religion and spirituality as kind of an affront to science. And they say, well, the actual things that need to be followed here are scientific principles. They say the science, you know, capital T, capital S. It is enshrined, you know, it's like the Ten Commandments. Like this is our guiding force. This is what we believe, and this is why we believe it. And when you're completely based in that like rational mindset, and you become so convinced of your own powers of intelligence and reason, you end up in situations like this where you think, okay, well, the only solution to this is things that humans can control. When the reality is, the planet is going to keep doing what it's doing, right? It has for many, many millennia before us, and it will after us if we cease to exist as a species. So this idea is just incredibly arrogant, and as cool as it may sound on the face of it, you know, carbon capture plants, you know, doing their thing, it seems to me that it's, yeah, like I said, a very arrogant way to go about it, and also just another business model. You know, of course, these people that built this spent, you know, God knows how much money on developing these technologies. They want to return just like anybody else. So regardless of whether or not this is actually effective in mitigating carbon emissions, or in this case, sucking carbon emissions out of the atmosphere, regardless of whether or not it's effective at scale, they're still going to push this because they got to make money like everybody else. So anyway, we'll keep an eye on this. Carbon capture technology is definitely part of the strategy as far as these climate activists and climate change strategists are concerned. In my mind, it comes back to always the same thing, and I will always push this, which is just let the ecosystems do what they do. Instead of building, you know, these multi-million, multi-billion dollar facilities that suck it out of the air, suck the carbon out of the air, and shove it deep down into the earth, just keep your fucking forests, right? Like, just stop destroying the forest. Those are carbon capture technologies right there. So there we go. I'll stop with that one. If you want to check these articles out, I'll link to them in the description. Check out I Fucking Love Science, just to look at the unbelievable arrogance of these people, because it's on full display in the I Fucking Love Science. You'll see the religious devotion to the Church of Reason and the Church of Science in there. We'll definitely cite more of the articles from I Fucking Love Science, because yeah, just like NPR, I gotta give these people a hard time, because sometimes they're just full of shit. So okay, moving on. What do we got here? Ah, yes, lab-grown meat. This one. Okay. This is a big one. This is from Forbes, and it says alt meat company Meatec set to build first cultured fat pilot plant in Belgium. And says, the article begins, Israeli-based cultured meat company Meatec 3D is putting people at the edge of their seats as they try for the first time their cultured nuggets made of plant-based protein and in-house produced cultured chicken fat biomass. The rising demand of meat is driving the search for alternatives that could as well lower its carbon footprint. Although more environmentally friendly than traditional patties, plant-based burgers and nuggets still do not fully satisfy consumers' expectations, as they lack juiciness and taste deriving from animal fat. Since 2019, one of Meatec's primary goals has been to reach that perfect juiciness and taste by adding just one single ingredient to plant-based. In 2021, the company acquired their now wholly owned subsidiary, Piece of Meat, a Belgium company which had been working on creating that missing ingredient in the lab. By adding their cultured chicken fat biomass to a plant-based protein, the result is a meatier, aromatized nugget that the company has started to put to test at food tasting in their headquarters in Rehovot, Israel, the epicenter of the country's food tech center. This is a quote. People say it's like it's science fiction. You really don't understand it until you've tasted it, says Arik Kaufman, co-founder and CEO of Meatec. Okay, so what is this? What are these alt meat companies? This is not, as was described there, this is not plant-based imitation meat. This is, in this case, in this particular product from Meatec, this is plant-based protein combined with actual animal, in this case, chicken fat biomass, which means that they're taking, I don't know what exactly that chicken fat biomass is. It's probably, yeah, just chicken fat. And they're actually culture, they're producing cultures of this. And I'm assuming basically growing this meat in a lab. Now, again, just like with the carbon capturing technology, on the face of it, this seems pretty cool, right? It's more humane than slaughtering animals. You could potentially scale this and make this cultured meat accessible to many more people, and at probably less cost. And you could probably do it in a way that limits the carbon footprint compared to traditional ways of growing animals and growing, you know, animal-based protein. But on the other hand, this just seems like a fucking bad idea, just like it always does when humans start fucking with things. Whenever we remove some inherent life, especially when we remove something that has some kind of, and when I say life or inherent intelligence, I mean anything from a plant to a mushroom to an animal. When we take that and we completely separate it from the environment that it exists in, whether in this case it's the chicken fat, when we remove it from the body of the chicken and we put it into a petri dish, and we just kind of see what happens, that is, there's just a lot of potential for things to go wrong. And it's just completely missing. It's completely been taken out of, like I said, the environment that it exists in. It's completely missing all the other elements that contribute to what that thing is. And it's completely, it's bastardized, it's humanized in a way, and it's controlled in a way that is just, it's at odds with kind of the natural order of things. And I've gotten in discussions with people about this, not specifically the cultured meat, but different ideas around cell cultures and this idea that we can, that people that advocate for this kind of thing would say, well, it's still natural because we're still allowing the natural process to happen, right? Like this, I'm assuming what's happened with this cultured meat is that these cells are just continuing to grow like they would if they were in the body of a chicken. Just in this case, they're doing it in a controlled environment, in a petri dish, so to speak, not literally a petri dish all the time, but in the lab. So people that advocate for this kind of thing would say, well, that's still natural. It's still a natural process. And my response to this is, well, no, it's not. Like, you've completely taken it out of its context and the environment that's existed in for however long it's been evolving, and it's been mingling with these other compounds and these other tissues in the case of the chicken. And you're creating something different. It's a form of synthesizing it. And there is this kind of fine line when you talk about synthesizing certain compounds or certain things like this fake meat, or not fake meat, but this cultured meat. So again, this just seems like, I don't know. It's interesting. It's certainly, I'm sure there'll be a lot of money behind it. I'm sure people will be on board with it. But again, this just seems like a human arrogance, humans just thinking that, well, we can do this, so we should. And I don't know, I'm always going to be skeptical, but we'll keep an eye on it. We'll see how these companies do, whether or not they're able to capture the palates of customers and people that like traditional, you know, just naturally grown meat. It's going to be interesting to see that naturally grown meat, if this cultured meat starts to take off, the whole idea of natural meat is going to take on a whole new meaning. Okay, so that's what I've got for you this week. Thank you for listening to the Weekly Blend. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Thank you for listening to the Blend, no longer the Weekly Blend, on the Greener House Podcast channel. This show lives in the same feed as What's What and our Music Plus Talk show, Vice Radio, available exclusively on Spotify. By combining these three shows into one feed, we offer an audio experience that is unique in the podcast world. So you can stay right here for stories and information about Earth Conscious Living, conversations about philosophy and literature, curated music playlists, and more. If you like what you hear, please follow us on Spotify, and don't forget to give us a 5-star review. If you're interested in visual and written content, check us out on Instagram at Greener House Media. Thanks again. This is Chris Syracuse coming to you from Bali in the Indonesian archipelago. We will see you on Sunday. Bias Radio.